I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Rick Edelman. Rick is 3 times ranked the number one independent financial advisor in the nation by Barron's. He is the chairman and CEO of Edelman Financial Services, providing financial advice for more than 25 years. Rick hosts weekly radio and television shows that air nationwide. He is a number one New York Times best-selling author who has published 8 books on personal finance. The 8th book, The Truth About Retirement Plans and IRAs, was published in April 2014. Rick, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on.
Well, David, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm not sure how far back you want to go, but I've been running Edelman Financial Services for 27 years now. My wife and I founded the company back in the 80s after we realized that there was really no outlet for ordinary Americans to obtain genuine, objective financial advice that was in their best interests. The only resources back then were stockbrokers and insurance agents trying to sell you something. And so we created the firm to provide an oasis for ordinary, hardworking Americans who are trying to get their kids through college and prepare for their own retirement and care for aging parents. And over the last 27 years, Edelman Financial has become one of the largest independent financial planning firms in the country. And we're very proud of our record of helping so many thousands of people all across the U.S.
So you clearly identified a need in the marketplace and a hole.
Yes.
And you have managed to catapult that need into great success for your company.
Yes, we've accomplished things that no one else in the industry has ever done. We have done things that no one has ever contemplated, and I think it's because my background is not from Wall Street. I didn't get an MBA. I don't have a degree in business or economics or finance. My degree is in communications, So I grew up in an entrepreneurial household. My mom and dad ran their own small business. And so we learned very early on that what matters is common sense, understanding and relating to people, listening to them very carefully. What are their concerns? What are their fears? What are their aspirations? What are their needs? And then helping them to achieve those goals. And that, I have learned over the past couple of decades, is not at all the approach that Wall Street typically uses. It's a shame. It's unfortunate. But we have been working hard to try to get the attention of the major players on Wall Street to show them our approach and to encourage them to adapt it for their own businesses so they can help more and more Americans achieve their personal financial goals.
But actually, what you touched upon are key elements that people who are successful entrepreneurs and successful leaders all use: communication, common sense, listening, understanding people's fears and aspirations.
Yeah, I think one of the things that sets us apart is our ability to communicate. And again, it's because I don't come from Wall Street. My degree is not in the world of Wall Street, and therefore my degree is in the area of being able to communicate. There are a lot of really smart people on Wall Street, obviously. A lot of financial planners in this country are very talented individuals. What they're not terribly good at, usually, is talking with ordinary consumers who don't understand the jargon, who don't understand the nuances of the industry. And that hasn't been a problem for me. And this is why I think my message resonates so well with consumers. I can talk in plain English. I can use humor. I can speak in language that you can relate to. And that's why we have mastered all forms of communication: radio, television, stage, print, electronic. And so no matter what way you're comfortable learning or hearing about the subject, we provide content for you that you can absorb at your own pace in your own style. And people really enjoy that. And it's unfortunately what I've come to discover, an uncommon trait among Wall Street practitioners. And I think you're absolutely right, David. That's the key. If you're going to be successful in business, you have to be able to communicate effectively. You have to demonstrate that you're listening, that you care, that you are responding to what you're hearing. And unfortunately, most in the financial services field lack that talent.
Rick, do you think that the need to be able to listen and communicate is any different now than it was when you started your business?
No, not at all. Because there are certain perennials that exist. It's almost like the law of gravity. There's nothing that changes the need for effective communication, the need to ability to understand who your client is and to be able to explain to them what they need to know in a way that they can comprehend, digest, and evaluate. And I don't think that ever changes. And I don't think it's unique to the financial services field either. I think it's equally applicable in the field of healthcare. I think it's applicable in the field of law. I think it matters when you're buying a car. I think it matters in the world of education. We've all had teachers or professors through our educational experience that we loved and others that we hated. And I'm willing to bet that in almost every case, those you loved were those who you were able to understand, who were able to teach what they were teaching and you to be able to absorb it. And those you hated were probably those you didn't understand a thing they said. So I think this is permeable in every occupation, every facet of life. We have to be able to communicate in order to relate to each other.
I couldn't agree more, and I've had those teachers in my life, and I have people in business that I have used repeatedly because they can communicate and I can understand them, and they listen to me.
So yeah,
I totally agree. And these are actually great ideas for people who are entrepreneurs in any field to hear. Which is these are the people who listen to this show. So thank you for starting off with this theme. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your own ups and downs as you were starting and growing your business.
Well, the biggest challenge for me when I was starting were two things. First, my age. I was very young when I entered this field. I was 28 years old. And let's face it, if you're going to be a financial advisor, you're going to generally be advising people with money. I mean, a lot of people in my field, we regard ourselves as social workers, and really to a certain degree, that's really true. But the real difference between us and real social workers is that social workers are often dealing with people with very limited incomes, very, very modest means, often in poverty. I don't. I tend to deal, if I'm going to brand myself as a social worker, I'm being a social worker to the wealthy, people with good incomes and who have saved money, $10,000 or $100,000 or $1 million or $10 million. But at the same time, we're still doing social work. We're still helping people deal with the concerns they have in their lives. It's not about the stock market. It's about their lives. What are they trying to accomplish? What's going on in their relationships with their spouses and their children? What is their attitude about transference of wealth upon death? How do they transfer their moral values to other family members, and how do they support the community and things like that. Money doesn't solve problems, it just creates new ones. Believe me, the guy with $10 million has problems. They just aren't the same as the guy who doesn't have $10 million. But the guy with $10 million will tell you he has problems. We can all judge whether or not he's for real, but he views he does. And so we spend a lot of our time doing that. And being 28 years old, well, how do I get somebody who's twice my age with $1 million to pay attention to me? I mean, what, you know, he's going to consider me that young upstart, that young whippersnapper. So one big issue I had was my age. The second issue was that my wife and I were living in the Washington, D.C. area, and we didn't have any family here. We didn't grow up here. We didn't go to school here. We relocated here following graduation. We went to school in the Philadelphia area. And so we knew nobody. We had no network, no social circle, and that's how most brokers or financial advisors or insurance agents start. They talk to their friends and family. Well, we didn't have any friends. We didn't have any family. And I was so young that how could I get somebody who was be a target client to be willing to agree to become a target client? So I realized that what I had to do was two things. Number one, I had to develop expertise. I had to genuinely be the expert that that 50-year-old would be willing to rely on for their financial advice. Second, I had to let that 50-year-old know that I existed. I know an awful lot of highly talented financial advisors who are virtually broke. And it's because nobody knows that they're a talented financial advisor. If I were to put a client in front of them, they would do a great job for that client. Their problem is they can't find any clients. And they don't know how to get the word out that they're talented and available. So I realized very early that being an expert in the field wasn't enough. I went to a lot of work and generated my own expertise through self-study, going to lots of classes. I eventually obtained 6 professional designations. I ended up teaching personal finance at Georgetown University for 9 years received an honorary doctorate from Rowan University. I've done an awful lot to make myself the expert worthy of a 50-year-old client wanting to turn to me. But that wasn't enough. Just having the expertise wasn't sufficient. What I realized, you ever hear that old saw, David, it's not what you know, but who you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't agree with that. I don't think it's who you know that matters. I think it's who knows you that matters. And so what I realized is I have to get people to know who I am. And again, with my communications background, I realized the mass media could be my answer. That if I can get myself on radio or television or an article printed in a newspaper or do a seminar and have 100 people show up, if I could get involved in the mass media, I can get out the message, the fact that, hey, I am an expert worthy of you to rely on for your financial needs. And so that's the work my wife and I went to doing. We focused on financial education and using the mass media to distribute that education. The first thing we did were seminars. We went to elementary schools and did seminars for the local PTA on college planning to teach parents of 10-year-olds how to save for college for their kids. And this was in the 1980s, and nobody understood the need for college planning, and the parents all objected, saying, why talk to us? Our kids are only 10. Go to the high school PTAs. Those are the kids that you ought to be talking about. And, of course, we had to explain to the parents, you can't wait till your kid is 16. Every parent in America knows it today, but nobody understood that in the 1980s. So we began with education in seminars, and I was able to stand in front of an audience of 50 people or so and demonstrate my expertise. And that's how we got started. Word kind of spread, and a radio station found out about me, invited me onto the radio to offer my financial education on air. And that interview led to more interviews. Eventually, I was invited to do my own show. Television invitations came along as well, and I was eventually offered to do my own television show. And now here we are, where my radio show is one of the most successful radio shows in the country. I'm in the top 100 according to Talkers Magazine. They ranked me the number 2 most important weekend talk show in the country. My television show has won awards. It's now in its 4th season on public television around the country. And the message has always been the same. We're going to convey our education, which, by the way, demonstrates my expertise. I'm going to give away my knowledge for free. And if somebody has an interest, they'll seek me out and we can talk about them becoming a client.
Rick, this is such an important point, and it leads me to a question, which is, when you started doing this, the methodology for gaining expertise and for learning was somewhat different than it is now, because now you have all these tools that are online, so there's so many different ways to learn, and there are lots of ways to access information that you couldn't access several decades ago. But the flip side is, in terms of getting known, there are so many channels that are available to communicate with an audience that I come across people all the time who have a challenge figuring out which channel to use and how to generate an audience in that channel once they pick a channel.
Right.
What thoughts do you have about that?
Well, twofold. First, the way I built my business cannot be done today. And I don't say that out of ego. I say that simply out of change of technology. Way back in the 80s, there was no financial programming in radio or television. Today, of course, there are entire networks devoted to the subject on both radio and TV. But back then, the only way to get on the radio was to have a local radio station's program director agree to put you on the air as a guest or as a host. And every city has one or two of these radio stations, which means you have that gatekeeper in your way. One program director determining whether or not you were able to get on the radio. That made it extraordinarily difficult. And I was very, very fortunate because I was a pioneer. I didn't know it at the time, but in hindsight, I was. And I was doing something no one else had ever done. I was one of the first guys on the radio talking about personal finance. So I got in a situation that today doesn't exist, because today radio stations aren't doing it in that way. Now they've recognized that the opportunity is simply to sell the radio time, and they treat it like an infomercial. You also have syndicated radio today that you didn't have before. You also have electronic radio that you didn't have before. You know, we only had broadcast. Now you have, of course, radio through the internet that didn't exist before. So as a result of all of this, you can't do it the way that I did it. But what you can do is do it the way that it exists today. And there are now many more opportunities. Anybody can have a podcast. You don't have a program director getting in your way. You want a radio show? Go start one. You can do it on the internet overnight. It's simple and easy to do. Now what you've got to focus on is, how do you let people know that that podcast exists?
Exactly, exactly.
And so you have to engage in the traditional forms of marketing. You have to engage in advertising and public relations and marketing and sales strategies to spread the word, because with the increase of opportunity, the bar has been lowered and anyone, the barrier to entry is gone. Anyone can do it. That means lots of people are. So you have to figure out a way to stand above the crowd to get noticed. And I don't think most entrepreneurs have that expertise, and they need to hire people who do. Hire PR firms, advertising firms, marketing firms, to help them spread the word.
Rick, were there things that you tried in your business that didn't work so well?
Of course. There are so many, I try to forget them all. I can't begin to tell you how much money I've thrown away and in total wasted efforts of things that didn't work or worked very poorly or seemed like a good idea at the time and turned out to be, in hindsight, the dumbest idea in the world. That's just the nature of the beast. You engage in testing and learning all the time. You are always experimenting. You are always trying new things and hoping that some of them will work. There's a slogan on Madison Avenue that 50% of all your advertising dollars are wasted. You just don't know which 50%. So the only thing you have to recognize is that if you don't advertise, nothing happens. If you don't engage in marketing, if you don't engage in outreach, if you don't engage in communication activities, the only thing you can be sure of is that nothing will happen. We find most people are unwilling to invest to make it work, or they are unwilling to invest enough money or for a long enough period of time. You can't just run a single ad in a local newspaper and expect to become highly successful. That's not how it works. Nor can you take the attitude that advertising doesn't work. And if that were true, why would everybody be advertising as much as they are on television and radio and TV and the internet and newspapers and direct mail? Advertising does work. If you haven't been able to figure out how to make it work, well, odds are you're doing it wrong. And that suggests you ought to hire someone who knows what they're doing, because you obviously don't know what you're doing. So you need to spend lots of money. You need to try lots of things. You need to be willing to fail, because failure is where your knowledge comes from. You never learn a thing from success. You learn from your failures. And if you're unwilling to fail, then you should not be an entrepreneur.
Let's talk a little bit about planning and failure, because you're in a business that involves a lot of planning. Why is planning important, and how does that tie in with failure?
Are we talking about specifically financial planning?
Well, you could tie it to financial planning if you want, but you can answer it however you like.
Sure. But in the context of entrepreneurship and business planning, the one thing that we never engaged in terms of our willingness to test and learn and our willingness to fail, none of that ever had anything to do with our clients. In other words, I never tried an investment strategy to see how it might work. I would never do that with a client's assets. The trial and error would have to do with our business strategies, with our hiring strategies, our communication strategies, our business activities. It never had anything to do with the client. You know, the hospital might experiment by putting the scalpels on the left drawer instead of the right drawer, but that has nothing to do with how they use the scalpel when performing surgery on a patient. That they're never going to experiment on a live patient with. And our attitude is the same. So you have to be very careful and prudent where you're willing to experiment. And as a default of all of that, you're engaging in everything through a very careful plan. You're not just being willy-nilly. You're not just trying something hoping it works. You are carefully planning. You are anticipating what is going to happen and then testing to verify your hypothesis. In other words, if I'm going to run a direct mail campaign, I'm not just going to spend a bunch of money to put a bunch of letters in the mail. I am going to anticipate how many responses to that direct mail campaign I'm going to get. And what are the quality of those responses? And I am then going to try to figure out through planning, how am I likely, most likely, to achieve that goal? If my goal is a 1% response rate, then how can I design that mailing? How do I time the mailing? How do I target the recipients of the mailing to most likely result in the 1% response rate that I'm seeking? That's how you plan. In other words, I think back to George Patton. He very famously said once that there's nothing wrong with taking risk. That's quite different from being rash. And that's the difference between planning and not planning. It's okay to do something you've never done before, and it's okay if it doesn't work, provided that you had a reasonable expectation for success. But just to do something without giving it any thought, that's not planning. That's not planned risk. That's just rash behavior and most likely going to result not only in failure, but a lack of learning from the failure. You're not even going to be able to point to why it failed, which means there's no learning. And if there's no learning, there's no opportunity for improvement. So planning is vital to every activity and behavior you engage in business.
Rick, I wonder if we could shift the conversation a little bit and talk about leadership in business. What do you see as some of the key ingredients for great leadership?
Well, it begins by putting your ego in check. Entrepreneurs, by definition, have very strong egos. If we didn't think we could do it better than the next guy, we would be working for the next guy. We wouldn't be building our own business. So we all think that we're better at this than anybody else. And many entrepreneurs take that a step further. They not only believe they can build a better widget than the next guy, they also believe that they can do every element of their businesses better than the next guy. They're better at HR, they're better at IT, they're better at legal, they're better at finance and accounting, they're better at operations, and therefore they want to do everything themselves. They don't want to hire anyone because they're not going to do it as good, they're not going to do it as fast, they're not going to do it the way I would do it, so I'll just do it myself. That's the death of a business. You have to put your ego in check and acknowledge you are not the best person for every job. And there are people who are frankly better at it than you. And even if they're not better at it than you, they're good enough to get the job done, which frees you up to go do the things that you truly are better at than they are. So the first element of leadership is to recognize that the best leader is the person who surrounds himself with people who are better than him, and not being worried about the fact that others are better than him. Instead, draw on their talents. I mean, how far would Bill Gates have gotten if he never hired anybody, or Steve Jobs if he never hired anybody, or Warren Buffett, he refused to buy any business run by another person? You're not going to get very far until you agree that there are others better at things than you. Then, for us at least, what I've always done is a few things. Number one is to make sure my team understands the mission. Again, this goes back to the whole communication thing. Mm-hmm. Making sure they understand what it is we're trying to accomplish. Who are we? What are we doing? Why are we doing it this way? What are we hoping to accomplish? Second, give them the tools that they need in order to perform. And third, get out of their way.
It's great advice. What roadblocks do you see repeatedly in business?
Failure of one or another of those three steps. Failure to communicate effectively the message. Many employees in many companies have no idea what the company does or why they're doing it that way, leaving the employees to just complain about the idiots up in the executive suite, or they don't have the proper tools that they need. They don't have the proper training. You hire somebody, and the first day on the job, you sit them at their desk, and you say, here, go to work. And they don't know what the work is. They don't know how to do the job. They don't know how to operate the computer or even use the telephone system. They don't know where the supplies are kept, and they don't even have the supplies that they need. They don't have the right software or computer systems or whatever other materials they've got. And so they can't do the job because you haven't given them the right tools. You're unwilling to invest in the business to give them the tools that they need. And third, You don't get out of their way. You're micromanaging. You're constantly looking over their shoulder and criticizing them relentlessly over what a lousy job they're doing or how long they're taking to do it or the fact they're not doing it the way you would have done it. And your micromanagement is not only destroying their morale, resulting in higher turnover, which puts you back to square one, it reduces your productivity and forces you to do jobs for people that you've already hired, and everything is redundant in the firm. So we find that where entrepreneurs get in trouble is that they fail to do the three steps I've outlined, set the mission, give people the tools they need, and then get out of their way. They either don't set those three rules, or once they set them, they violate them.
Rick, what are you working on now that's really exciting?
Oh, we're always working on a whole bunch of things. I'm working on my next book, my ninth book. We are looking at making some big changes in how we deliver client services. We are expanding our client access to us. To ultimately, our clients will have 24/7 access to us. We're looking at it and enhancing the ability for clients to reach us as well with video technology. We're expanding our educational offerings for clients, and we're looking at continued growth, and for the first time, possibly growth by acquisition. There are some other financial planning firms that we think would be great additions to ours because we're very similar and like-minded, but we have attributes they lack, and so we think that it would be a win-win for not only our two firms to merge, but also beneficial for their clients as well. So we have an awful lot of very exciting things going on right now.
Right. And it sounds like you are, as part of this process, you're continuing to tap into what the marketplace needs and also looking at what's going on in terms of changing tools for communication and changing technology landscape and trying to take advantage of that and serve people in a way that could be very beneficial to them.
Yes, we have to recognize that technology is becoming more and more dominant in our society, and we have to adapt. We have to deliver our advice and services using technology in ways that we never conceived of in the past. This is requiring a massive investment and focus that, frankly, we didn't anticipate, but there is no choice because clients are demanding these services, and if we don't provide them, our competitors will. So it forces us to reinvent ourselves all the time, and it's great news for clients because they will get better service more frequently in ways they wish to digest and absorb our advice and services. So it's great news. And it'll also provide us the ability to serve even more people than ever before, which is also great news, not only for our firm, but for the millions of Americans who are still desperately in need of financial advice and investment management services who don't know where to turn to get it.
It's interesting, and also you're touching on another key issue, which is that standing still in business is never an option.
Oh, that's absolutely
right?
True, yeah.
Even if you've gotten to be as successful as you have been with your firm, you still can't stand still because the whole world around you keeps changing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, unfortunately, the world of business are like that of sharks. They say that sharks never sleep and never stop moving or they die. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a good analogy for us. In business, you're always growing. I use the airplane analogy. You're either moving forward and rising in altitude or you're declining. But the notion that you can just stop where you are and enjoy yourself, that's the death of a business. So you have no choice. Grow or die.
Great. So, Rick, prior to this interview, one of the questions that we had planned to talk about is someone who's been influential to you in the development of your career. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, that would be my dad. Being in a family of entrepreneurs was, I think, what set the stage for me to start my own business with my wife. My mom and dad ran their businesses forever, and so you hang around at the dinner table, and mom and dad are talking business. You know, they're talking about the company and all the issues associated with it. They're talking about staff and HR issues. They're talking about issues such as marketing strategies and business strategies and new products and new services and new markets they want to get into. They're talking about banking and finance and capital issues. They're talking about taxes. They're talking about competition. They're talking about regulation. This is just natural dinner conversation for a five-year-old. And then you go to their office during the week and on weekends, and you watch them running their business, and you watch them with their customers, and you watch them engaging. So you grow up in this kind of environment and household, and you begin to realize as an adult that although dad never said a thing about here's what you need to do to run a business, he essentially taught me every day through osmosis. I just absorbed it all through that environment. And I think that's true in most households. This is why actors tend to have children who become actors, and lawyers have children who become lawyers, entrepreneurs have children who become entrepreneurs. And although I think my dad probably wanted me to go into business with him, which my older brother did, my path led me in a different place.
Interesting. But, what kind of business was it?
My father created – he was a tournament promoter, and he created the world's largest bowling tournaments, which today my brother still runs that business. And it's for people who are in the bowling industry, they're household names. Outside of the bowling industry, people are kind of shocked to realize that there is such a thing as a bowling tournament industry. But he's built a huge business in that world, did things that no one ever did before, and along the way mastered all elements of the business. He ended up publishing his own newspapers. That's how he promoted his business, and his newspapers were distributed free to bowling centers all around the country and free subscriptions to league bowlers. And he built his business through journalism and newspapers that he created and published on his own. So I learned very early on, being really good isn't enough. Creating a great tournament's not enough. You got to let people to know about it so they come out and bowl. So his business was a really great example of American entrepreneurship.
It must have been a great learning environment.
Completely. Of course, not realizing that that's what was happening to me at the time. It's only in hindsight I can realize. People sometimes ask me, well, how do you know this stuff? Where'd you learn this stuff? And I realize I'm just doing many of the same things that my mom and dad always used to do.
That's great. Rick, shifting gears for just a minute, who do you know personally who's doing really remarkable work?
Oh, that's a big list. Many of them are in the field of technology, because that is one of the largest areas of opportunity these days. Peter Diamandis is one example, the founder of the XPRIZE Foundation. He's the guy responsible for the private space flight that occurred a few years ago. He's now got a company that's trying to launch spaceships onto asteroids so that we can mine them for minerals and bring the minerals back to Earth. There are a lot of folks in the technology sector that are doing very important work using exponential technologies that are going to have a very big impact on many aspects of our planet, solving many of the biggest problems we have about poverty and nutrition, healthcare, education, energy, and environmental issues. And so I would encourage people to stay very closely plugged in to what's going on in the world of exponential technologies, and you'll discover that there are innovative ways for you to apply them to your own business as well.
That's a great tip. Rick, you've given us so many great ideas and great tips for both entrepreneurship and leadership that I think our listeners will have a lot to digest listening to this episode.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed being with you.
Yeah, Rick, could you tell listeners how they can learn more about you and your company?
Sure. You can visit us at rickedelman.com. That's spelled ricedelman.com. Or go to edelmanfinancial.com, and you can learn all about the advice and services we provide and all of our educational material to help you achieve your financial goals. You can get downloads of our radio show podcast and our television show episodes on PBS, and info about all 8 of the books that I've written and all the seminars that we present all around the country. So we have lots of financial education and information, all of it for free. You don't even have to register. It's just all there for you at your leisure at rickedelman.com.
Great. We'll put those in the show notes. Rick, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Rick Edelman, Chairman and CEO of Edelman Financial Services. Thank you again, Rick, for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.